Welcome to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today is the award-winning author John Grisham. He's written 50 best-selling novels, which have been translated into nearly 50 languages. More than a dozen of his books have been made into movies. His third Jake Burgance novel, A Time for Mercy, is being developed by HBO as a limited series. In 2006, Grisham published a nonfiction book, The Innocent Man, a chronicle of Ron Williamson, wrongly convicted, who was sentenced to death row and eventually exonerated. Grisham's latest book is his second work of nonfiction, which chronicles the cases of 10 other people who have been wrongly convicted and the Herculean efforts that were taken in attempts to secure their freedom. It's called Framed: Astonishing True Stories of Wrongful Convictions. John Grisham co-wrote the book with Jim McCloskey, the founder of Centurion Ministries, an organization that since 1983 has fought to vindicate the wrongly convicted. Mr. Grisham serves on the Centurion board. Last October, John Grisham, Jim McCloskey, and two exonerated people from Maryland, Michael Austin and Walter Lomax, spoke about the book and the issue of wrongful convictions at the Enoch Pratt Free Library in an event that I moderated. John Grisham and I spoke about the book a couple of days before that event. Because our conversation was pre-recorded, we aren't able to take any calls or online comments today. John Grisham joined me on Zoom from his farm in Virginia. John Grisham, welcome to the show. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So let's begin by having you tell us a little bit about Centurion Ministries. This is the organization that your co-author, Jim McCloskey, founded. You're on the board of that organization. What do you all do?
Well, it's an amazing organization founded by Jim almost 50 years ago when he was a divinity student at Princeton. He got involved with a prison ministry and met a guy in prison who finally convinced Jim that he was innocent. And Jim was very skeptical because, you know, everybody in prison claims to be innocent, or so he thought. So Jim began investigating the guy's case and came to the belief that he was, in fact, innocent. And so he started talking to some witnesses and investigating, and over a period of 2 years, finally put together a case that exonerated the man. He walked him out of prison. And Jim was studying to be a minister, and Jim has told me the story many times. When they walked out of prison and the inmate was reunited with his family, he said, God spoke to him. And God said, this is your calling in life. And so for 50 years, Jim has worked to exonerate 71 people. He founded Centurion. It's a very robust, successful innocence advocacy group in Princeton. And it's fun to serve on the board with people who enjoy this type of work. It's one of the best national organizations for innocence advocates in the country.
One of the dedicatees of this book is the Innocence Project, founded by Barry Scheck and some other folks, and you have also worked with them. Does Centurion do the same kind of work as the Innocence Project does?
Same kind of work. It's a little bit different. The Innocence Project is the nation's largest. It's sort of the cornerstone of the innocence movement. But there are probably 50 innocence groups at any given time in the country. Anybody can start one. It doesn't have to be a law school or a lawyer. Most of them are attached to law schools, though. They pop up. They do some work. They lose money. They go away. Another one pops up. But they're all over the place. I'm here in Virginia. There's one at the University of Virginia, one at Richmond University Law School. They're all over the place. And they all network. They're all doing the same work. There's not enough lawyers in the country. Our innocence advocates to take all the cases because there are so many cases of wrongfully convicted people. But the Innocence Project in New York is the big one, founded by Barry and Peter 30 years ago. And I've been on that board now for probably 15 years.
How did your interest in innocence issues develop? You wrote this nonfiction book again, it was your only nonfiction book back in 2006 before this new one. How did you get involved?
Well, it wasn't planned. I was having far too much fun writing novels, and I had never thought about wrongful convictions. I was a lawyer in a small town in Mississippi for 10 years. Most of my clients were criminals. It was court-appointed criminal cases, and I did a lot of criminal work and had a lot of clients, and most of them, were guilty. Most of them went to prison. I did the best I could. I never had a client I thought was wrongfully convicted. I didn't know that really happened. I knew the judges, I knew the prosecutors, I knew the police, and it was a very efficient system. I just never thought about wrongful convictions, and I missed the first big wave of DNA exonerations in the mid 90s. And then in 2004, one morning I read the obituary of Ron Williamson, who had obviously just passed away. And he was convicted in his hometown of Ada, Oklahoma, sent to death row, and came within 5 days of being executed for a murder he had nothing to do with. He was a small town sports hero. He was the first draft pick of the Oakland A's in the 1972 free agent draft. In his little corner of Oklahoma, people thought Ron was the next Mickey Mantle, and he thought so too. All the scouts thought so. He was a great sports hero. And I was fascinated by the case. I was fascinated by how a small town like that could turn on one of its heroes. And boy, did they. He was framed for a murder. He had nothing to do with. He was mentally ill at the time and railroaded into prison and forgotten about. And again, came within 5 days of being executed before a very smart and brave federal judge stopped it. And finally, Ron was able to get it with some lawyers and get DNA testing, which was new in the early 90s. And he was exonerated, got out in 1999 after serving 12 years on death row. The fascinating case.
There are fascinating cases throughout this book. There are 10 of them. You write about five of the cases. Jim McCloskey writes about five of the cases. And there are a lot of commonalities between each of these cases of wrongful conviction. Has to do with law enforcement misconduct and a variety of other things. What through lines did you find in researching these cases and your work with the Innocence Project and Centurion? Because there's some, it seems that the kinds of mistakes or nefarious activity that happen around these cases are consistent to some degree from case to case.
Yeah, nefarious is a great word. These are not honest mistakes made by hardworking, honest policemen and prosecutors. These are cases of willful misconduct, and they're infuriating. And in every innocence case, they're all very, very different. The facts are fascinating, but they all have common causes for wrongful convictions, whether it's bad forensics, junk science, or whether it's bad identification, which is a huge problem. Most 25% of our exonerations involve false confessions. There are about seven or eight reasons all told for wrongful convictions, and every case is going to have most of those elements. In many cases, you see incompetent defense lawyers, you see prosecutorial misconduct is rampant, police misconduct is rampant, and in these cases, they all come together, and you have these common themes are played out over and over and over, and are still being seen today in wrongful conviction cases. We have not stopped wrongful convictions. They're still there. And we have thousands of innocent people in prison. Most people don't believe that. But when you get involved in innocence work, you realize how many innocent people are there. And we can only get out a few of them at a time. It's fairly easy to convict an innocent person if the police and prosecutors want to do so. It's not that hard. It's almost impossible to get one out of prison. It takes about 10 years and about $500,000 of donated money for testing and all that kind of stuff. It's very, very hard to get an innocent person out. The Innocence Project is the biggest group in the country. I think we're at 375 exonerations, all by DNA, in the past 30 years. DNA has been a godsend. DNA has made it all happen because now we have clear, unassailable biological proof that, they got the wrong guy, or should they point the finger at the right guy?
John Grisham is my guest. He's the co-author, along with Jim McCloskey, of a new nonfiction book called Framed: Astonishing True Stories of Wrongful Convictions. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our conversation was pre-recorded earlier, so we're not able to take any new calls or comments today. So, John, you write at one point that the road to a bad conviction often begins at the crime scene with a misguided hunch. And I was just shocked and appalled how many times investigators would be at the crime scene and develop a theory of the case right off the top of their head at the moment, and then be dogged in their pursuit of convincing themselves it was true, even if it wasn't. This is something that happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, and if you go back to the Williamson case, the innocent man at the crime scene was a rape, murder, terrible, terrible crime. But these small town detectives in Oklahoma were shocked at the how bad the crime scene was, and so they just had a hunch that it had to involve two perpetrators. That's just what they believed at the very moment because of there was so much blood, and that was dead wrong. Eventually proven by DNA. But that set them on a path to find two people. And once they have this hunch, and once they start working on this wrong hunch, they develop tunnel vision, and they will accept anything that supports their, their conclusion, their hunch, and they will discard anything that might send them another direction, the truth. And it happens time and time again. It happens in most of the 10 stories we write about. The police get off on the wrong foot immediately, and then will not stop and review where they are. And most of these cases, when you read them, you can't believe. You keep asking yourself, why didn't the cops just stop for a moment and reconsider the evidence, reconsider where they were, and maybe call time out and say, we could have the wrong guys here? But that, well, I don't know how often it happens, but it happened. It doesn't happen enough that you have so many wrongful convictions.
The very first story that you write about concerns a group of guys known as the Norfolk Four. And in this case, the police overlooked what seems now to be a very obvious suspect. And they falsely charged not one person, but four people. They actually charged four different people. And at one point, they had a theory that might have involved eight people committing this crime. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Well, I could talk about that story forever. One of the difficult parts of writing this book was we decided we had to limit each story to 10,000 words, which is virtually impossible. These stories are so incredibly complex, and they go on for years that you need 200,000 words to tell the story, but you can't do that. So we tried to condense everything down to 10,000 words. And it was very difficult, but the Norfolk case is a prime example. A terrible rape and murder of a young woman, and the police at the crime scene were looking around at all the spectators. The neighbors were gathered around the front yard where it happened, and one of the neighbors said, "That guy over there, he's kind of suspicious." And there they went. They zeroed in on this guy who was a sailor. All four guys were sailors. And they started questioning this guy. They took him in for questioning. And it all deteriorated after that. They just had the hunch. While the crime scene technicians were inside the house gathering evidence, which would prove that only one person did the crime, okay, they collected a lot of semen from the crime scene. They had the biological proof. While they were actually collecting evidence that would lead to the real killer, the cops outside the apartment were already chasing the wrong suspect. And that set in motion a chain of events that at times is impossible to believe. They verbally abused the four sailors. They got bogus confessions from all of them, and none of the confessions matched because they were all bogus. And it took, the four guys spent 9, 10, 11 years in prison before the real killer, who was under the nose of the cops, finally admitted. The cops didn't catch him. He admitted to the crime while he was in prison for another rape. So it's a fascinating case.
It is. And, there's all sorts of things that happen, again, from case to case when it comes to false confessions. We remember that happening in the case of the Central Park Five back in the 70s in New York. You say that one of the common mistakes is that these people who are considered suspects often waive their Miranda rights because they think, well, I'm innocent and, there's nothing I have to worry about. But in terms of, some of the legal decisions they make early on in the investigation, they can really come back to haunt them.
80% of all innocent suspects will agree to a polygraph. It's a fatal mistake. They all waive their Miranda rights. If you're innocent, you're going to waive your rights because you know you're innocent and you trust the police. That's a fatal mistake right there. Crooks and criminals know better. You know, they clam up and say, give me a lawyer. Innocent people said, innocent people want to help the police prove they're innocent. So they'll waive their Miranda rights, and then the questioning starts and it deteriorates quickly. And then, you know, after 4 or 5 hours, when the suspect is really on the ropes and cannot believe what's happening, then you start to break down mentally and emotionally. And then the police, their favorite dirty trick, it's their favorite dirty, they still do it. They say, okay, well, if you're innocent, take a polygraph. And 80% of all innocent people will agree to do that. It's a fatal mistake.
And I want to talk about that after we take a quick break, because this is a really, really interesting dimension to these cases about what police are allowed to do when it comes to administering polygraph tests. And we're going to talk about that in just a second. John Grisham is my guest. His latest book is co-written with Jim McCloskey. It's called Framed: Astonishing True Stories of Wrongful Convictions. Our conversation was recorded earlier, so we aren't able to take any calls or online comments today. We'll have more of my conversation with John Grisham on the other side of a quick break. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is the acclaimed best-selling author John Grisham, a master storyteller. His latest book is a compendium of true stories about people who have been wrongly convicted of serious crimes and how most were eventually exonerated. He co-wrote it with Jim McCloskey, the founder of Centurion Ministries, an organization that advocates for those who have been unjustly incarcerated for crimes they did not commit. It's called Framed: Astonishing True Stories of Wrongful Convictions. John Grisham and I spoke about the book last October. Because our program was recorded earlier, we aren't able to take any calls or online comments today. So, John, we were talking before the break about polygraph tests. You mentioned that so many people, 80% or so, agree to a polygraph test. Why is that a bad idea?
It's the favorite dirty trick used by police officers during a very heated, long, extensive, even abusive interrogation, and with no lawyer present, and the defendant has been subjected to verbal abuse, a lot of verbal abuse, probably not physical abuse like in the old days, but these are still brutal interrogations that go on and on. And then at some point, the sort of out of frustration, the police will say, the detective will say, well, okay, if you're going to prove it, why don't you take a polygraph test? And again, 80% of those people who are innocent will say, okay, sure. They want to prove their innocence. And they'll go through the whole procedure of, you know, calling the examiner in and wiring the guy up and, you know, going through all the questions. And the exam takes an hour or so. And then they put the suspect back in the interrogation room, you know, dark room in the basement with no windows, no lights. And then the detective walks in with this graph paper and he's furious. Okay. He'll throw the paper at the suspect and say, you took the test and you flunked it. You flunked the test. Okay. Now we know you're lying. When in reality, the suspect passed the test or the test was inconclusive. But you don't have to tell the truth.
It's legal. It's legal for the police to lie about the results of a polygraph test.
They can lie about everything. If there are two or more suspects, they separate them and they'll say, okay, the other two guys have already confessed and said, you pulled the trigger. That's a lie, okay? But that's what the games they play. That's legal. Our Supreme Court has said, yes, you can do that. With a polygraph, at that point, the suspect it begins to think, well, maybe I did do something. Maybe I was dreaming or whatever. That's a common trick. Now, a couple of states, I think last year, passed laws saying that the police could not lie to minors. Can you imagine a 15-year-old kid being subjected to that type of interrogation in the past when the cops could just lie and threaten, and they threaten you with death. They threaten you with the death penalty. They threaten you with everything, okay? These are horrible interrogations that are done without being filmed. Now there's a film projector in the room right there. It's ready to be used when the confession is ready after 15 hours. They've got the video recorder right there, but they won't use it because they don't want you to see what they're doing. Some states have now passed laws that you have to film all interrogations, which is a great law, okay? But most jurisdictions don't do that. More and more are doing it. So, I mean, we're trying to clean up the interrogation process. 25% of our DNA exonerations so far with the Innocence Project involve false confessions. People say, well, I would never confess to something as terrible as a rape or a murder if I didn't do it. That sounds great, okay? We all believe that. But things are different when maybe you're not that emotionally strong, maybe you're vulnerable, maybe you're easily manipulated, whatever. Everything changes after 15 hours of nonstop interrogation. They know how to break you down. And so we have this horrible problem with wrongful confessions that problem could be solved if we pass the right kind of laws about lying to witnesses, about lying to suspects, about threatening, about filming. Just film the interrogation. So that's what happened in the Norfolk case. They got four sailors over a period of weeks and months. After prolonged, brutal interrogations, they got four of them to confess. And again, all the confessions were different. Nothing matched anything else because it was all fabricated. And it took that's why they were convicted. Jurors, once you confess, you're dead. The jury's going to believe you. I don't care what the proof is, because nobody believes you would confess unless you were guilty. And appellate courts are going to uphold the conviction if there's a confession, and you're out of luck if there's a confession.
Now, in addition to being a lawyer and a wildly successful novelist, you were also a state representative in the state of Mississippi for a while. These laws that concern the implementation or the giving of a polygraph test and who can lie and when they can lie and laws about videotaping and stuff, these are all subject to state and local jurisdiction. Is there any role of the federal government in that regard? Can the feds at one point, can the Senate and the Congress, pass laws that would govern such things?
Only for federal prosecutions. Almost all prosecutions are state prosecutions, and that's subject to state law. And yes, I served as a state lawmaker 40 years ago, and I shudder to think of some of the things I voted for back then. I wasn't much of a politician. I didn't last very long. I got fed up with it pretty quick after two terms and quit. But no, I'm sure I voted for some real crap back then. But I was a lot younger, and I was 30 years old, and it's amazing some of the things you believe when you're young, and some things you do when you're young. And hopefully, I've matured since then. But no, there's no real. There could be some federal guidelines. We're trying to pass a federal forensic law that would clean up the courtrooms and make witnesses have to be certified, require certification of certain witnesses. Because there's so much junk in the courtroom. There's bite mark. One of my stories is about bite mark analysis, which is wildly unpredictable and not even scientific. Hair analysis. Ron Williamson went to prison and went to death row because of some faulty hair analysis from the crime scene. Scalp and pubic hair they found on the scene. It was not his, but at trial they said it was his. Years later, DNA proved it wasn't. So there's all kinds of junk science. We're trying to pass some national standards as far as forensics, and some states are doing a great job. Texas is doing a great job with its Forensic Science Commission. We're trying to get other states to do that, but passing a federal law would, unless the Supreme Court, banned, I don't know, banned the death penalty, banned, they could certainly, on constitutional grounds, they could do that. But passing federal laws to control state prosecutions is very difficult.
You quote Abraham Lincoln, who said famously that no man has a good enough memory to be a successful liar. Yeah. You alluded to this earlier in our conversation today about the use of jailhouse snitches. So many people in jail are offered deals in return for testimony that validates the prosecution's theory of the case. The pervasiveness of this, reading this book is just shocking.
It's shocking.
And this is the kind of thing that defense attorneys can't work through. It seems like they're not able to get enough information to poke holes in these arguments.
Well, it could be controlled. I mean, some countries outlaw snitch testimony. I think the Canadian model is that they have to have a separate hearing to bring the witness in, the snitch in, the informant. Let's call him an informant, jailhouse informant, in a separate hearing before the judge, who will grill him about whether or not he's cut a deal with the prosecution, whether or not he's been promised something to testify. And then this has a tendency to chill a lot of this false testimony. But the problem is that the average juror who doesn't want to be on the jury, but that, we're all good citizens. We go, we serve on the jury if we're supposed to. The average juror does not believe that a witness will come into the courtroom, swear to tell the truth, take the witness stand, and start telling these fantastic, incredible lies that have been prompted by the police and prosecution. You can't believe a witness would just lie and lie and lie about a story. And that's what they do. Informants are usually career criminals who've been in a lot of jails. They know how the system works. They're all facing more time for drugs, almost always drugs. They don't want to go back to prison for 10 years. And they know how to play the game. And the cops know them. They know the cops. And so you got a sensational murder in town, or a rape or something, bad crime. And they have a suspect. They don't have a lot of proof. So they need more proof. So one way to create proof is to go to this informant and say, hey, we're going to put you in the cell with this suspect. And let's see what he says. See what he knows about the crime. Well, the informant knows, if I do this, I'm going to get something back. They cut a deal. They cut his sentence that he's looking at. They cut his time in prison he's facing. So they cut a deal. And so the informant goes in, spends a couple of days in the jail cell with the suspect, who probably he doesn't know anything about the crime. But the police will feed the informant enough facts to be able to talk about the crime. And then he'll pop out and say, hey, this guy bragged about the crime. He bragged about killing his wife. He bragged about all these horrible things. You got your man. And so the snitch then gets out of jail. And 6 months later, when the suspect is on trial, he's forgotten about the snitch. The guy shows up in court, with a haircut and a coat and tie on, looks pretty presentable. And he sits in the witness chair and swears to tell the truth and starts lying. That happens all the time. And the police know he's lying. The prosecutors know he's lying. Sometimes the judges know they're lying. And, that's never a problem.
And you write that, the snowball effect of the lying. I mean, in this Norfolk case again, you write that so many lies were told by so many people at so many levels and in so many ways that for so many reasons, the truth became irrelevant. Hard facts gleaned from the crime scene never changed, but they were willfully ignored by the police and prosecutors. So it's not one lie or two lies, but it's this, compilation of lie after lie after lie that after a while, nobody can sort through them.
It becomes very complicated, but it complicates a simple crime. In that case, they had the crime solved if they had just checked the DNA. The suspect was right there in the community. He was a known rapist. While they were messing up the lives of these innocent sailors, he committed another rape just around the corner from where this one happened. This murder happened. It was his third or fourth rape in less than 6 months. He was there, and he was convicted of that and went to prison. And while he was in prison, he confessed to somebody, and word got back to the cops. When the word got back to the police, they tried to hide it. It's just more and more lies. But the case could have been solved quickly if the police had just done their jobs and not ruined the lives of these four young men who were U.S. sailors, who were dreaming of careers in the Navy, They were kids from Michigan, Ohio, Texas, and North Carolina, and they were just 20-year-old boys pursuing a big adventure and proud to be sailors, proud to be Americans. Most of them were Eagle Scouts. They were taught to respect police, and they did, and they trusted the police, and that was a fatal mistake in Norfolk, Virginia.
And just to be clear about it, it's the legal obligation of the prosecution and police to turn that kind of information over to the defense counsel, isn't it?
That's been established for a long time. But if there's evidence that's exculpatory and proves that they're tends to prove or might prove that the defendant didn't do it, police and prosecutors are required to turn the information over to the defense. That rule is violated every day.
All
That
right.
that's one reason people complain. Why do these cases, these death penalty cases, take so long? Before we execute the people, we want more executions. That's what you hear in the death states. And one reason is it takes so long to find the truth. It takes so long to find the evidence that was hidden by the police or hidden by the prosecutors. It takes years after the trial, after the sentencing, after the person's been on death row for years. If he's lucky, he's got good lawyers who are digging and digging and trying to find the evidence. But the exculpatory evidence often comes up 5 or 10 years later, once they can dig and find it.
The book is Framed: Astonishing True Stories of Wrongful Convictions. The author is my guest, John Grisham. He wrote it with Jim McCloskey. Our program was recorded earlier, so we aren't able to take any online comments or calls today. We'll have more with John Grisham after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're listening to a conversation I had last October with the internationally acclaimed best-selling author John Grisham. His latest book is his second work of nonfiction, which tells the stories of horrendous miscarriages of justice in 10 cases in which innocent people were charged, convicted, and incarcerated. The efforts to exonerate them were undertaken by Centurion Ministries, which has been advocating for the wrongly convicted for more than 40 years. The founder of Centurion Ministries, Jim McCloskey, is the co-author of this book. It's called Framed: Astonishing True Stories of Wrongful Convictions. Grisham and McCloskey each chronicle 5 cases, which include eerily similar instances of misconduct by law enforcement, faulty evidence, lousy analysis by inept experts, and other ways that justice was obstructed. In all of these cases, innocent people were subjected to decades of unjust incarceration and sometimes death sentences. Since its founding in 1983, Centurion Ministries has led the legal fights that have freed more than 70 innocent people. Because my conversation with John Grisham was recorded earlier, we can't take any calls or online comments today. John Grisham joined me on Zoom. So, John, you write about something that I think everybody knows almost instinctively, that there is a great racial dimension to the miscarriages of justice that you chronicle in this book and just are aware of in the scene across the country. You write that since we started the war on drugs in the 1970s, the number of prisoners skyrocketed, but the drug use has hardly declined. We investigate, we arrest, and indict black people in a very different way than we do for non-people of color. Talk about that dimension.
Wow, that could go on for hours. Race is a factor in so many wrongful convictions. Race is a factor in criminal prosecutions from the crime scene to the initial suspects, to the investigation, to the indictment. It's well known that black defendants are treated differently from white defendants. Most cops are white. Race is a factor in jury selection. Race is a factor in criminal representation of indigents, of the testimony presented at trial, the composition of the jury. Race is a factor in guilt or innocence. Race is a factor in sentencing. It's there at every turn in most criminal prosecutions. Not everyone, and not one thing we try to do with the book, though. There are 10 cases. I think there are something like 20 different defendants or suspects, or whatever you want to call them, exonerees that we talk about. There are four in one case, three in another, two in another, total of about 20. And I think half are white and half are black. We wanted to use some white cases to show white people that it does happen, because most white people don't believe that there are thousands of innocent people in prison. Black people know it because they've lived it, they've seen it, they're familiar with it. But most white people just don't believe that these cases really happen. So we included some of the more notorious, white defendants. Ron Williamson's case, my first one from Oklahoma, everybody was white. The victim, the all jury, everything. So, I mean, race is not always there. And not every black person is mistreated by the system. But too many of them are. And race is still a huge factor in every aspect of criminal prosecutions.
We talked about DNA evidence and how important that has become, and how you've used it with Centurion and with the Innocence Project to free a number of people. But the whole science of forensics, and in particular autopsies, there is a chapter that you wrote in which you report the very first autopsy was done on Julius Caesar. So this goes back a ways. And there's a fellow in here named Dr. Stephen Hain. And in the late 80s, 1988, he did 320 autopsies. But just 2 years later, he was doing 1,200 of them a year. And his personality, the way he presented when he gave testimony in court, just wowed jurors for years and years. But it turns out he often didn't know what he was talking about.
He was a very smart, talented, slick doctor and con man. And he cornered the market on autopsies in Mississippi back in the 80s and 90s, because there was no statewide medical examiner, no statewide crime lab back then. And I take my share of responsibility for that, because I was in the state legislature back in the 1980s. We could never properly fund a crime lab or keep a medical examiner for some reason. That was not a priority. But Dr. Hain was smart enough to corner the market on autopsies. And so in your rural counties, most of them are rural, if there's a murder, the county coroner, who's still elected by the people and has to and is not required to have any medical training, the county coroner was and still is responsible for obtaining an autopsy. Most doctors, pathologists, don't want to do them. They just don't want to fool with it, because they don't pay anything. They don't pay much. Plus, they don't want to have to go testify. Well, Dr. Hain came to town in I think the mid 1980s, and started volunteering to do all the autopsies. And he became very popular with the police and sheriffs and all that, because he would do them quickly. He worked very fast, and he would, he always had a backlog. He always had several bodies waiting to be autopsied. But he started charging a lot of money, and he became very, very popular with the police and prosecutors, because he would say in court, testify to pretty much anything the prosecutor wanted. Critical dates such as issues, facts such as time of death, location of the body, th things like that. He could pinpoint those facts to suit the prosecutor. And he was very good with juries. He was from California. He was the expert from afar. He went to med school at Brown. He had this wonderful vocabulary, big words, small words. He had a way of connecting, wore a nice suit and tie. He was believable. And these rural juries just always believed Dr. Hain. And he was responsible for We don't know how many wrongful convictions he was responsible for because he was the expert. And there are still people in prison today in Mississippi and Louisiana who were there because of Dr. Hayne. He was responsible. The prosecutors were complicit because they knew him so well, and he was such a favorite that he would tailor his conclusions to support their theories of guilt. And he did that time and time again.
One of the things that really shocked me reading this book is the propensity of police and prosecutors to accuse people with no motive whatsoever of capital murder. And it seems that if someone's going to be tried for capital murder, a clear reason that they might have committed the murder is a really important element in the case. There's a fellow named Joe Bryan. He was 46 years old. And he was imprisoned for 34 years for killing his wife, whom he loved quite obviously and for quite a long time. There was no particular reason at all for Joe Bryan to kill his wife, yet police decided that he did. He was denied parole 7 times, you write. Tell us a little bit about Joe and why do you think it is that police are willing to believe these crimes are committed by people who really don't seem to have any reason to do it.
Joe is one of the few people I wrote about that I actually knew. I met him when he was in prison in Beaumont, Texas, about 6 years ago, and he was never going to get out. He had no more appeals. We couldn't. He had great lawyers that they could not prove anything else. There was just no proof. The jury had already believed everything. Joe was 2 hours away from home the night of the murder. He was in a hotel room in Austin, Texas, and attending a conference. Joe had 2 college degrees. He was a high school principal in the town of Clifton, Texas, and his wife Mickey was a grade school teacher. But both educators, career educators. They could not have children. They loved children, and they loved each other. They were totally devoted to each other. Did everything together, and she was brutally murdered in their home that night when Joe was gone, probably by a rogue cop who later killed himself. He later became the prime suspect, but the case was never solved because the cops screwed it up so bad. And so Joe was found guilty. He couldn't believe he was accused. He was stunned when he was accused, and the town at first rallied around Joe, and because no one believed it. The cops had the wrong person. Anyway, they put him on trial. They presented some really shaky, bad forensics, some bad evidence, some bad blood spatter analysis by a so-called expert that kind of sealed the deal. It was also a case of a small town wanting to believe the police and prosecutors. You want to believe the authorities, and so these unsophisticated jurors believed what the cops were saying, and Joe was convicted and spent by the way, he died a month ago. He got paroled about 3 or 4 years ago because of COVID. The Texas parole system is very harsh, like most of the penal system in that state. And Joe's parole was turned. He's a model prisoner for 35 years. And he finally got paroled because of COVID. He had a heart condition. They were afraid he was going to die in prison, so they finally let him out. So he had about 3 years of freedom after spending 35 years in a Texas prison. And but he kept his humanity. He kept his soul. He kept his Christian faith. He made the best of a horrible situation. But they took 35 years away from Joe and his family and his friends and his money and everything, because the cops were just so incompetent, and they were determined to pin somebody before they finished the investigation. There was no motive whatsoever for Joe to kill his wife. He wasn't even in the same town the night it happened. It's a fascinating case that I got really close to because I was close to Joe, and again, he died about a month ago.
And it's just such a sad story. And the scope of this problem, And you've mentioned that there are likely thousands of people who have been wrongfully accused and convicted in prisons now. There was just an event that happened last month in Mineral Point, Missouri. A man named Marcellus Williams, who had been on death row for more than 20 years. There were all sorts of people wishing to reexamine the case, including the prosecutors from the office that convicted him. Yet that execution went through, and Mr. Williams was executed, you know, after I said 20 years, on death row. We're talking like 1,500, 1,600 people have been executed since the 70s when the Supreme Court lifted the ban on capital punishment. Where do you see this going? Do you see the innocence movement picking up steam?
Oh, big time. Certainly. It's being proven in the numbers. The death penalty is dying in America, not because of brave lawmakers, not because of courageous judges or prosecutors, but because of courageous jurors who finally, after many, many years, the laws have changed such that the juries now are able to know more about the defendant. Let's say the guy's he's clearly guilty of a terrible murder. No one has sympathy for that. But once he's convicted during the sentencing phase, nowadays, most of the time, the defense lawyers are much better and they are allowed to kind of bring up his past and you see where this guy came from. And so many of these people who are very unsympathetic, you know, never really had a chance in life. Some horrible background. So the jurors are able to hear that now, and the jurors are given a choice. And time and time again now, they say, okay, we don't want to kill this person. So let's keep him in prison for life. And so the life without parole has become a big factor. So the number of death verdicts declines every year. The number of executions declines every year. And the number of states with the death penalty is declining. Not sure what the current number is. I live in Virginia. We outlawed it 3 or 4 years ago. I think the last state to do so. But yeah, it's, and when we, you know, we like to think those of us who are caught up in this kind of work, we like to think that the work we've done, these high profile DNA exonerations are finally having an impact on jurors. And we know they are. People are not as willing to accept everything the police and prosecutors say.
John Grisham. The book is called Framed, Astonishing True Stories of Wrongful Convictions. I spoke with John Grisham last October, just before he came to town for a panel that I moderated at the Enoch Pratt Library, with John and his co-author Jim McCloskey, as well as two Marylanders who were wrongfully convicted and after lengthy prison terms were finally released and exonerated. Walter Lomax and Michael Austin joined that panel, which included a lively conversation in front of a sold-out and enthusiastic audience. Thanks for joining us today for this archive edition of Midday, and thanks for subscribing to our podcast. You can catch up with any show you may have missed on the WIPR app or at WIPR.org. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.